Good morning. The anger over the Sitlai expansion won't end, and with whether the Honolulu City Council will override the mayor's veto. Tomorrow, the council meets to consider the question and six more bills aimed at the homeless. Councilwoman Ann Kobayashi joins us today. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The Ebola outbreak in Liberia was officially declared over in early May. After spending 6 months there, Dr. Tom Crabtree is spending his first full week home in Hawaii. We'll talk with him later this morning.
And a Kailua author wonders how Dracula might feel if his domain were invaded by tour buses. We'll meet Fred Barnett, author of Bats, Return to Damalot. And 150 student dancers prepare to take the stage in Prokofiev's Cinderella. I'm Chris Vandercook, and later we'll hear from Alexander Dance Academy's Danelle Watson.
The conversation for Tuesday, June 2nd starts now. Here's the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
For most of us, a public health emergency is an abstraction. We've never really seen it up close, yeah?
But we got a good lesson in the last year.
Yeah.
And that's the subject of our first conversation this morning. Now, when an email starts off, "Aloha from Liberia," it could be tempting to write it off as a possible exercise in phishing. This email, though, the one that we received, well, it wasn't. It was from Dr. Tom Crabtree, an Oahu surgeon in charge of the clinical side of the USAID Ebola Treatment Unit. At the time he wrote us, the Liberian outbreak had been declared over, and after a six-month stint in West Africa, he was looking forward to being home. Dr. Crabtree is spending his first full week back in Honolulu, and he joins us in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back, and glad you're here safely.
It's great to be back.
I can imagine. I mean, people say that it's nice to be home, but for you, it's really nice to be home.
You just can't imagine.
In the Ebola story, as we saw it unfold, we went from apocalyptic to pretty much the end of the outbreak, at least where you were in Liberia. As you look back over the time that you spent there, what made the difference?
Well, you use the word apocalyptic, which is exactly how anyone should and did describe it back in September, October, with bodies in the streets. And then, as you pointed out, come January, February, people across all spectrums, healthcare, government, really realized we were getting ahead of it. Why were we getting ahead of it? Nature gave us a break, and also the world got in front of it. There was enough people, resources, stuff, just downrange to address it.
When you put some of it to luck, what specifically do you mean?
Luck is defined in this case as Ebola just decided to give us a break. It decided to, for some reason as yet undetermined, not continue to amplify the transmission rates, not continue to break out in places where there weren't resources in place to address it. Again, a huge element of luck.
In the part that you mentioned where the world got ahead of it. It took a little while for that to happen, but it seemed that once it did, it was full throttle. Was that your experience?
It truly was my experience. I saw the countries, America obviously was focused on Liberia, but the Brits had Sierra Leone, the French had Guinea, and everyone was on a warlike footing. I mean, planes after planes after planes, just bringing material, people, medicines. The amount of forklifts at any given airport was just astounding. The overall effort, again, was you could compare it to a war.
And many people did. I mean, and we could see these ETUs just spring up out of nowhere.
West Africa has some of the most remote and untouched jungle you can imagine, and places 100 miles from the nearest road of any sort, an ETU would pop up overnight.
So as we are talking today, there's a very good chance that very, very soon Sierra Leone will be declared outbreak-free.
Correct.
And then Guinea, though, is still lagging? behind that?
It is. Liberia is now roughly 60 days Ebola-free. But remember, that definition didn't, or that 60-day count didn't start till 42 days after the last Liberian Ebola patient was buried. So it's been quite a while in Liberia since there's been an Ebola patient. Sierra Leone, there are still a handful of active cases being treated. They're in quite remote areas. And Guinea, a few more. Probably just a matter of geography and the amount of resources. Guinea is on the tail end in terms of resources and also is a bit more remote than the other two.
As we have been talking about Ebola for now most of the last year, there's also been the issue of whether Ebola is mutating. From what you saw while you were in Liberia and the people with whom you were doing research, is Ebola mutating?
I don't think people think it's mutating. It's been studied extensively and obviously continues to be today. Instead, we have a far better understanding of how it is transmitted. The big fear, but again an unfounded fear as of today, is that it would become airborne or transmitted via the respiratory route, like a cough or a cold or a flu. And that does not seem to be the case, fortunately.
So it's still back to bodily fluids or touching someone?
Correct.
We know there's going to be a next time.
There will be.
Because the disease is not eradicated. But what will make the difference in the next time is what we're able to carry forward from this time. What are those lessons that you think we absolutely have to remember? And what variables do you see that might somehow mitigate those?
The instructive tale here revolves around several things. First, on a societal level, it's Ebola etiquette. The people very quickly learned to drop the normal elements of daily life in terms of personal interaction, handshakes, hugs, kissing. People just stopped doing that. No one ever touched anybody. Second, social rites like funeral rites. People stopped doing what they had done for centuries, for millennia, where they washed the dead. But from a public health standpoint, the things that were most, had the greatest impact were contact tracing. When someone gets infected, immediately isolate or identify and isolate those people that were exposed and follow them, and not let them continue to infect and create a chain that's hard to break. Those lessons, contact tracing, Ebola etiquette, and having treatment and triage and protocols in place when people do get infected, that's a powerful three-headed tool to use.
There are still those variables, as we began the conversation discussing when you said that there was a real degree of luck in how well Ebola was handled this time. What are some of the variables that concern you as we look at potentially what may happen next time?
Well, this Ebola outbreak is the first one that was really ever occurred in an urban setting. And it first broke out in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. The big fear is that it will break out in a place where there is no Ebola memory, no institutional memory, no public health structure to deal with it. And there are many of those places around the world. So the big fear, all of us that have been involved in this, is that it will happen in New Delhi, India, or some other super city that people just haven't had the exposure to it, and then it will just flash, and whether we are lucky or not, it will just be out of control.
The issue would be whether you could get ahead of that one quickly enough and people would respond fast enough?
And it would be difficult to do.
So now here you are at home. What has been the reaction to you since you've been here a whopping, over a week?
Well, you know, family and friends, of course, happy to see me back. People understand that Ebola has not been in Liberia for quite some time, so we're able to hug and give each other a kiss, et cetera. But there's still some people, and completely understandably so, that have a bit of caution, a bit of standoffishness. You know, it's very similar to back in the day when I was a surgery resident in San Francisco in the early 80s, where HIV, we took care of HIV patients. We didn't even call it HIV at that point, but people, again, just didn't know what it was all about, but they knew it was something that could potentially hurt you very bad. Obviously, as a society, we've matured tremendously with HIV and the like, and I think we'll get there, too, with Ebola and other infectious diseases, but we're not there yet.
But as you saw some of the reaction to the Ebola patients that were brought back to the United States, how did you want to explain some of that to the greater populace, despite all the information that was out there?
Well, it was hard to explain because we didn't have the answers. I mean, people still weren't early in the outbreak, people still weren't convinced that it wasn't something that was transmitted only by body contact, by body fluids, because, for instance, with the Dallas nurses, at one point people were like, well, look, they had all the gear on, they did everything right, they didn't, you know, what happened? So there was a huge element of just unknown, and unknown things create fear.
So if you were to leave us with one issue about Ebola that you want us to remember, what would it be?
It would be to, number one, recognize as a taxpayer, it's worth every dollar sending people, material, energy, expertise downrange and getting ahead of it before it comes back to our shores. While we have a great health system here, the real success in fighting this disease or any disease is fighting it at its source.
And when you say here, do you mean here as in the United States or here as in Hawaii?
Both. I mean, Hawaii, we're obviously the entrance for the Pacific, and while Ebola is not going to pop out of the Philippines and come here, it's probably not going to pop out of China and come here. Certainly the respiratory illnesses, like the news in Korea today, those were far more likely to land here in Hawaii than they are anywhere else when it comes to the United States.
So for that, you're turning your attention to now?
No, back now to plastic surgery for a little bit.
All right. Well, we're glad that you're back and safe and sound, and thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Dr. Tom Crabtree is a local plastic surgeon who's also the group medical director of a firm that provides health care to international organizations. He's back in Hawaii after a six-month stint in Liberia. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:17, and coming up, what one resident might do to keep Transylvania, Transylvania. Time now for your quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, oahu, umolokai. Ulana, umau, ukaholabe, uhavaiti.
Starting tomorrow, we'll spend the rest of the week broadcasting from both Honolulu and the island of Maui. With that in mind, we're taking a look at the history of the first scheduled inter-island flights to Maui for today's backyard quiz. On November 8, 1929, 51 Army and Navy airplanes flew in formation over Honolulu. They flew in honor of Aviation Day and to celebrate the inauguration of a new airline offering commercial flights to neighbor islands. Inter-island service for the new airline began on November 11, 1929, and before long, flights from Honolulu to Molokai, Maui, Hilo, and Kauai became available. Back then, a flight to Maui cost $20 even, and passengers were limited to 20 pounds of baggage unless they wanted to pay a fee of 25 cents for every pound in excess of the limit. For today's quiz, we'd like you to name the airline that initiated commercial airline inter-island service in 1929. For a hint, we'll tell you the airline later changed its name to Hawaiian Airlines. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, toll-free, if you know the answer. The first caller that gets it right wins an HPR T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Lee Stack from the Chinatown Improvement District. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
vampire genre, like vampires themselves, refuses to die, but the vampire satire genre may be ready to take on a life of its own. That's one way to describe Fred Barnett's novel Bats Return to Damelot, in which Vlad the Impaler struggles with the encroachment of tour buses on his centuries-old castle and plans to turn his beloved Transylvania into a theme park. Is his chamber of horrors destined to be turned into a tourist trap? Fred is on the hand to sort it all out for us. Good morning, Fred.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
Nobody likes seeing his sanctuary invaded. And as a Kailua resident, do you see any parallels in all of this?
Well, of course, yeah. This, of course, was inspired by the big buses rolling into Kailua. Originally, the story was inspired, I told you a little bit earlier, I was down on the beach. There was a woman from Romania with her two kids visiting Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
A little old lady. She was about 4 feet tall, about 40 pounds, wearing a black shawl. She came up to me on the beach wearing a black one-piece bathing suit and started ranting to me about how I should go back to my old country. I told her that I have relatives in Hungary and how I should go defend my country against the government over there who stole her money, made her husband disappear. She had a good point and good reason to rant. But anyways, that inspired me to think about the witch. And then when I got home to Kailua that day, I saw those buses, and I said, what would happen if these buses came into a hostile country? There was a story about how they wanted to turn Vlad Dracula's castles into amusement parks, and that kind of pulled it all together.
Well, one of the my favorite illustration from the book is of a ride called Tragic Mountain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have the Bring Out Your Dead hay rides. We have all kinds of things. They have the whole thing set up. It really is fun. There's a beautiful picture of the whole amusement park built as they return to Damelot. When I say they, it's not only Vlad, but his main squeeze, Elizabeth Báthory. And if you know Elizabeth Báthory, one of the worst mass killers in history, she bathed in the blood of virgins. And then you have Vlad the Impaler, killed thousands and thousands of people on his own.
Fairly reprehensible people.
Yeah, completely. And even though their habitat is dead, they still have these buses coming in the morning, and they can't sleep in their castles, and they get very upset.
Because, of course, they sleep during the day, or at least Vlad does.
Yes, and for hundreds and hundreds of years, both Vlad and Elizabeth have been wandering around like William Powell and Myrna Loy in The Thin Man, just making blood cocktails and really having nothing to do except weird shape-changing sex. And all of a sudden, their whole world is turned upside down by these tourists moving in.
Are they a couple of jaded sophisticates like William Powell and Myrna Loy?
Yeah, I wrote the dialogue, so it went along those lines.
If you were alive for several hundred years, you would probably be both jaded and sophisticated.
And not only that, they've gotten so complacent that they won't get up and do anything about it. He's killed off all of his armies long ago. She has killed practically anybody that could help her.
So they're sort of at a disadvantage in keeping the country in there.
And so they have to employ the witch. Her name is Lupta Axe, to find their relatives, if there are any. And the only two that she can find are two of their offspring who are living in California. They're basically hippies. They have no idea where they came from. They're brought back to Transylvania, or tricked back by the witch. And turns out that, this is the new blood that Transylvania needed. And they get the ball rolling.
And few would argue that Transylvania is in need of some, right? Especially since they've wasted all their opposition.
Yeah, there's not much left. But, the reality in this Transylvania in the book is, it's just a way of life, of last ways and Elizabeth's murderous ways. And that's what they've been doing for centuries. And to them, it's not necessarily good or bad. It's just the way Transylvanians in this kind of world do things.
Well, sure. But Fred, in the quest to sort of make the characters, give them these various personality quirks that they have, and it looks like there's quite a variety of them, where do you steal those from?
Well, Vlad himself, I based on my father. A lot of his expressions in the book, a lot of his expressions are my father's expressions. Like there's this point where his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, Jonathan, says, you know, let's split. And, you know, then he says, let's split like an axe to the skull. And Vlad says, ah, that's my boy, make a mess, you know. And that's one of my father's great expressions, always make a mess. And he was more of a Zorba the Greek type of guy, you know, real gruff, real full of life, actually, not full of death.
But when, as a writer, when you see a personality trait, you know, just when you're out, do you sometimes say, you know, I'm going to file that away, I could use that?
Oh, God, yes, yeah. Well, I have had years working with bosses. My two Van Helsing twins, the industrialists in the story, are based on those micromanaging bosses who are actually one person but enough for two personalities. Anyways.
So you've got ample material to put into
it? Always, always. And the point with this book is it's not just a bloody, gory mess, not at all. Everybody in the end ends up in love. There's two zombies who had lost each other hundreds of years ago, and they go through this tragic 16th century romance, writing letters back and forth about one guy losing his arm, and she's got tuberculosis and loses all her kids, and her husband dies in a fire, and they think that each other are dead. They come back at the end.
It's wonderful when that happens.
Yeah, it's heartwarming if they had a heart. it's a very happy ending. Everybody, you know, comes together at the end. Big Disney endings. Basically.
Well, terrific. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and it's an honor.
Fred Barnett is the author of Bats Return to Damelot, which looks at Vlad the Impaler's efforts to keep Transylvania, Transylvania. And you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
And we have it at Bookends if anybody goes into Kailua.
Unarmed, dangerous, and dead.
Just by categorizing these things, we can hope to come to better conclusions about what type of people are being killed by police.
The different dangers for suspects in America when the police pull out their weapons and suspects die. A whole new national picture from a team of journalists looking deep into the numbers. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Today, Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell is expected to announce a plan to create temporary container housing at Sand Island for the homeless. Tomorrow, the City Council will vote on the budget for next fiscal year, and we'll talk with Budget Chair Ann Kobayashi later in the program. The mayor's overall strategy, though, is still in the making after its announcement last fall. So, after 9 months, what's the status of his affordable housing plan? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So 9 months or a baby's worth, what's changed?
I was joking with our reporter, Anita Hofschneider, about the gestation process, and she wrote the story that's up there today on the site. And what we hear from city officials is that the plan is still in progress, this affordable housing strategy that Caldwell has come up with. Remember, when it was unveiled last September, a lot of people said, boy, that's pretty aggressive. That's actually even revolutionary. Now we're hearing from the city that it probably is more like July or August. And the reason has a lot to do with the requirements of technical analysis and consulting with all the stakeholders that are involved.
And how about with the city council?
Well, the council, you'll be talking to Ms. Kobayashi later. You can get her input. She, for example, was not crazy about funding out of the city's budget, the Office of Strategic Development. She wondered why the mayor couldn't fund that more out of his budget. That issue is on the agenda, I believe, tomorrow for the council, whether to fund more of those staffing positions. But the biggest thing that has not happened with the plan is what's known as exclusionary zoning. And that is where the city council would require every large new developer to set aside a percentage of units for low or moderate income residents. This is different than existing policy, which really only applies to zoning changes, and then you have these units that are set aside for that. Now, if this policy had been in place, had been adopted, D.R. Horton, its whole Old Peely project, boy, that would really have changed significantly. But in fact, there is no policy in place yet for this very transformative idea requiring affordable housing units.
So, Chad, with inclusionary zoning, what would the difference be in terms of numbers of units? Is there any way of sort of comparing that of where we are now, where we might have been if we had this policy already in
there
place?
Were only something like a couple dozen units, I think, that were created in 2014, not very many at all. That figure is still imprecise in terms of how many they would set aside. That's one of those discussion points they're having. Another thing has to do with how long those units would have to be afforded. Would it just be 10 years? Would it be 60 years? Now the mayor is looking at maybe 30 years as a compromise. So that's another big consideration.
Which we know goes by in a blink of a moment, you know, in terms of 10 years or 30 years. And the case has been made that eventually, if that keeps happening without new units coming online to replace those units that might then slip into market value, you're still going to be behind the curve.
Right. Remember that, and we've said this several times on your program, that it's estimated Oahu needs 11,000 affordable rental units by 2020. That's only 5 years away. We are well under meeting that goal right now.
All right. Well, we're going to hear what the mayor has to say a little later today and see what the city council does tomorrow. And between those times, we're going to talk to Ann Kobayashi a little later this hour. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair is a reporter for Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
For just about a year, advocates for the homeless have added two words to their lexicon for angry words, sit, lie. The bill to make sitting or lying on a sidewalk has expanded from Hawaii's most famous beach to neighborhoods to the east and west of Waikiki. And although the latest extension was momentarily thwarted by a veto from Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, the Honolulu City Council will meet tomorrow to consider overriding it. It will also look at a handful of other bills aimed at the homeless, including one by Councilwoman Ann Kobayashi, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
When the mayor said that he would veto the bill and did, his concern was that it was not going to be legally defensible. How concerned are you and excuse me, and the council that what you're crafting now may also not be legally defensible?
Yeah, well, you know, we all do not like this sit-lie bill and having to do all these different proposals. However, when the mayor first introduced sit-lie for Waikiki to, you know, benefit the tourism industry, you know, we feared that where are the homeless going to go? Where are the people going? And so the administration said, well, they'll have this center at Sand Island and everyone could go there, and it would be open in October of last year. So we passed the sit lie, and what did happen happened. I mean, what we feared would happen did happen because everyone needed a place to go, and so they moved across the Alawai and came into Makali, Mo'ili'ili, Kapahulu, Chinatown, downtown, and it affected the small businesses there. So we felt we had to do something, not against homeless, but to make sure that our sidewalks are walkable and that our small businesses survive, because they suffer when the sidewalk is blocked.
For what you said going into the conversation, that what you feared would happen happened, that homeless people simply move from one place to another.
Yes, I mean, where are
that
they going?
That continues to happen, though, without a place for them to be.
Exactly.
Later on today, the mayor will be talking about a possible plan to have container housing at Sand Island. If that happens, will there be a need for expanding CITLI?
Well, we'll see. You know, we can always pull back on it. As I say, people have to go somewhere, and Sand Island may not be the best place, but at least it's a place they could go as we build affordable housing. I mean, building affordable housing is not easy. And just siting a building in a neighborhood is difficult. So, and the cost of building affordable housing. So we have to look at what government can do. If we could provide the land, if we can help with the cost of infrastructure, then maybe more developers would go into building low-cost housing.
As you look at the status of the mayor's plan that we were just talking about a moment ago in the reality check, how would you grade it?
Well, because it's temporary housing, probably C. I mean,
and the overall strategy?
Well, thing is, temporary housing is fine for a short period of time. Each unit does not have its own restroom or electricity. It's far from employment, because many of our homeless are working, and they just can't, you know, if you have to pay $900 in rent and you only make $900, what are you going to do? You have to give up your apartment, and then because you have to feed your family. So many of our homeless are working, and hopefully they'll be able to get to their job site from this Sand Island location. And that's why it's difficult, as I say, finding a place that's convenient and acceptable to the community that we're building.
So as you look at the mayor's plan, which was to have, you know, pockets of housing units sprinkled throughout of the city and county of Honolulu, and as it was announced last fall and people really thought this was quite progressive, how would you rate that now in the time that we've seen these last 9 months?
Well, you know, I think it's been difficult, as I say, to find city lands where we can do what the mayor has said. He's also been talking with landlords, trying to get people into rental, into apartment buildings. So, I mean, it's not an easy task, and I think it's been progressing, not as fast as we had hoped, because when the CITLI bill passed originally, Waikiki, you know, of course, got cleaned up, but then all the other areas were inundated. So, you know, I don't know what we just have to find these temporary housing to put people. Find them a place to live. I mean, it's really not a good situation we're in. We're trying to clean up the sidewalks so people can use it as sidewalks. We're trying to help the small businesses. We're trying to help the homeless people so that they do have a place to put their belongings and sleep at night.
For a lot of this, some would say that it comes down to money and funding appropriate programs. Is that how you see it?
Yes. Well, you know, I went to San Francisco and looked at, they have a great program. Their mayor, Ed Lee, is doing a great job. But they have all these companies there, Twitter, Google, and they donate millions of dollars. And so the city is able to purchase old buildings, renovate them, provide more housing units. They're doing a couple thousand, I think, this year. Seattle did the same. Bill Gates donated $40 million to the city of Seattle, and they were able to buy up buildings, build new buildings to house people at low cost. So it does take money.
So you're looking for private investment, but at the same time, the city also has a responsibility to help fund. Has enough money been put in that direction, and how do you assess whether that's good money after bad or just good money?
Well, you know, it's as I say, if we could help the developers by providing the land, city land, state land, whatever land we can provide at you know, say $1 a year, help with the costs of the infrastructure, the water lines, sewer lines, et cetera, and then maybe developers will then come forward and be able to build low-cost housing. You know, it's a lot of money and a lot of risk for a developer to put up a building. So we have to do what government can do. It's a whole partnership. That's what I've always been saying. It was what San Francisco has been saying, that it's a community effort. Everyone has to help in this whole problem of homelessness. Federal government, state, city, nonprofits, developers. Everyone has to work together.
And a lot of those people that you just named or sectors think in some way that they really are. But from the city's perspective, they need to have, according to what the mayor has said, a devoted group of people to administrate all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
you've said that you don't think that that's necessarily something that should come out of an additional appropriation, but more from what's already been appropriated.
Well, you know, this is the third year of his four-year term. He has very good people working for him. He has an Office of Housing, the Community Services Department. They've been doing, I think, a very good job. And, you know, we have to move forward. We have to work with the resources we have. Most people in Honolulu know that you have to work with the resources you have and be creative and make things work. We can't stall things because three people aren't being funded. They are being funded. He's hired these people since November. And I told him, you know, we have nothing against that. You found the money to pay them, so keep paying them at from whatever sources he has.
And the additional four members that he would
like
to hire?
Yeah, if he can find the monies to do that. He found it for the other three. They each get paid, you know, over $100,000, $120,000, I think. And then we'd have to find space for them. We'd have to do more rent, computers, you know, benefits, retirement. You know, there are lots. It's not just hiring a person. There's a lot associated with it. And I think the people he has now that are working for him are wonderful. I think they've been doing a good job the past 3 years.
All right, well, we'll see what happens when you and the council meet tomorrow.
Yes.
And vote on that budget. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And Kobayashi represents District 5 on the Honolulu City Council and chairs the Budget Committee. Tomorrow, the council will consider whether to override Mayor Caldwell's veto of the Sitlai extension and also to consider six other bills. Now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. Now, this morning we asked you about the history of the first scheduled inter-island flights to Maui and other neighbor islands. Had you been around Honolulu on November 8th, 1929, you would have seen those 51 Army and Navy airplanes flying in formation over the city in honor of Aviation Day and the inauguration of a new airline offering scheduled commercial flights to the neighbor islands. 3 days later, the inter-island flights officially began, and before long, the new airlines established regular routes from Honolulu to Molokai, Maui, Hilo, and Kauai. When we fly to Maui a little later today, the fare won't be the even $20 per person, but those $1,929 would have the buying power of about $276 today, so kind of even. But back then, there was only a 20-pound baggage limit, unless a passenger wanted to pay a fee of 25 cents for each pound in excess of the limit. For today's quiz, we asked you to name the airline that first initiated commercial inter-island service. And although you know that carrier today as Hawaiian Airlines, in 1929, the company began as Inter-Island Airways.
And Beth Ann, David Lee of Kaimuki did know that, so he is today's winner. He gets a HPR T-shirt. And that's today's quiz at 8:49. If you've got one for us, please do send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Cinderella, queen of the day.
Dance academies do all they can to pass along professional skills to their young charges through hard work at the ballet bar in their studios. But their instructors will be the first to tell you there's no substitute for stage experience or for contact with professional dancers. Maui's Alexander Academy Performing Company will do both when it performs Prokofiev's Cinderella this weekend. Its 150 students will get a chance to work with Alvin Ailey dancer Daniel Hunt, who will dance the role of the prince. Alexander Academy Executive Director Danelle Watson is on the phone from her studio. Tell us more. Good morning, Danelle.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure. This is kind of an exciting opportunity for your dancers to be partnered with a professional, yeah?
It is. I can't tell you how the excitement with all the kids. He's back for a second year. We had him last year with our Swan Lake, and just revving up in the countdown to the days coming. He's very inspiring, not only a good partner, but just very charming in his personality and a great teacher at heart. So he's definitely been an inspiration to all the students.
What makes a really good partner, Deno?
Well, he's a great teacher, so he's very forgiving. Our students don't have the opportunity to have regular partnering classes. We don't have a lot of advanced male dancers at our school, so it's new to them, so it can be scary. But timing, being able to be there for them, trust is a huge issue.
Sure.
And when they make a mistake and something goes wrong, he is so compassionate and right there to teach them to, you know, make it work. And he's incredibly encouraging and positive.
At that level of skill, it's really important to sort of have an attitude that lets the skills come out, yeah?
Yes. And we don't have time on our side, so he's here for, you know, 2 weeks. And kids have exams as part of that 2 weeks and end of school year. So, yeah, there's definitely skill involved in not a lot of time. So, it's actually, the audience won't know how little time they've had together because they're trained dancers, both our students and, of course, Nathaniel.
And part of the training is being able to take the stage with confidence, yeah?
Yes. Our advanced dancers have experience. We don't get on stage as much as I would like, but they take the pressure to the stage incredibly well. And, of course, Nate, he's been dancing with Ailey too, traveling around the country, and his performing experience is professional.
When he talks to your dancers about the things that performing experience has given him, what kind of things can he pass along?
I think without even trying, he passes along a passion for the art. He really makes the dancers, reminds them of coming from a place internally and from the heart. So it's not all just about steps and strength and flexibility, so that they're telling a story and getting the compassion and just making the athletic part of dance become more artful. And I don't think he intentionally does that. He just does that.
But that's kind of the last layer that has to be added on to all the layers of skill and training, right? Now you have to make art out of it, which isn't necessarily just technique, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why these performances are so important. It does give the dancer, when they get that live audience, it gives them that reminder, and they do come from a deeper place with their movement quality.
You've obviously, you know, in the course of teaching dance, you've had many young dancers have their first stage experience under your care, and inevitably there are lessons learned that you didn't, that the dancers themselves didn't anticipate. What kind of things do they tell you that they learned from getting on stage for their first times?
Some are first-timers that go on stage. They usually learn a little bit on how to deal with their nerves. So they get nervous, and, you know, their heart rate and all that's different, and just sure. dealing with the nerves and going for that. Or also being in the moment. There's usually a lot more energy put towards something when there's the pressure of an audience or someone watching. There's the, you know, having to think fast if you all of a sudden forget your steps. And mostly, I would say the majority of the kids, though, when they go there, they just get a sense of energy. And as soon as, you know, if they're nervous and they exit, they're like, I want to do that again. I want to do that again. And some compare it to as exciting as Christmas. So
so there's a level of excitement that that you can channel that into onstage energy, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Energy increases immensely. That's why we do these shows. It makes the kids work harder and steps them up. They all become better dancers as soon as the show is over. They've all improved.
I would think so. Danelle, thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Danelle Watson is the executive director of the Alexander Academy Performing Company, which will perform Prokofiev's Cinderella at Seabury Hall's A'ali'i Kuhonua Creative Arts Center on Saturday and Sunday, June 6th and 7th. Showtimes are Saturday at 2 and 6 p.m., Sunday at 2 p.m. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
On Saturday, June 13th, in HPR's Atherton Studio, is the Hawaii premiere of 10 Piano Etudes, commissioned and performed by Sarah Davis Buechner. One of today's leading concert classical pianists, Ms. Buechner has performed in some of the most prestigious venues on four continents and now shares her artistry with you. June 13th at 7:30 p.m., call to reserve your seats at 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org.
Beth Ann, I was really struck by one of the things that the doctor back from Liberia said, which was that the Ebola virus sort of decided to give them a break because these are things that have lives of their own. And sometimes a public health emergency can be abated by the disease just sort of dying down. Seems to be what happened in this case.
Truly, and very lucky that it happened.
Yeah.
Will it always happen? Probably not.
Probably not. That's right.
No complacency there.
Yeah, and it's very likely, as he said, that we will be facing more public health emergencies in our lifetime. It's something people really need to understand the nature of.
And change some behaviors, even if we don't necessarily like those behaviors that we have to move toward.
You bet.
That's going to do it for us for this morning. Coming up tomorrow, a two-island show. We're going to look at the growth on Maui. And is a mayor obsolete?
Plus, a historian looks at the battle that changed the course of the Pacific War, Midway. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and give us your comments. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. Our BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more information about guests and topics are there too. Just look under talk shows for the conversation on HPR2.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning from Maui for more of The Conversation. See you then.